Radiothon, and it kicks off on Thursday, November 27th at 8 a.m. and concludes Saturday, November 29th at 10 a.m. That's 50 hours of original first-run programming right here on CFRC 101.9 FM.
You are listening to CFRC Radio from Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca.
Good morning. It is 11 a.m. on Friday, November 21st, and you're tuned in to CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and this is Kingston Currents. CFRC's news programming is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, Wanalaiwer at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. The holiday season is starting to take shape downtown, and with it comes one of the Downtown Kingston BIA's annual traditions, a new pewter ornament collection. Now in its 31st year, the series continues to document some of the city's most iconic buildings and landmarks. This year's lineup includes three new buildings, a well-loved park, and a piece marking a major local college anniversary. I spoke with Jan McDonald, Downtown Kingston's Director of Events, about this year's collection. So the collection has been part of our holiday season for over 30 years now. I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about the tradition and what you think makes it such a hit every year.
I know, it's kind of crazy that every year we still find buildings and these sort of cultural sort of assets in the city to make into pewter ornaments. You'd think after this is our 31st year that we would sort of run out of buildings. But no, Kingston is so historically rich that, you know, it seems like we have an endless pool to choose from. So we've been doing this for 31 years, five ornaments every year. We get suggestions. We have so many customers who have every single collection from year one. They get super excited whenever we do the new release. But we get suggestions, all the time, a lot of suggestions from Kingstonians, which is great. It's always a fun thing to do. I think it's really nice for locals, but then, you know, we have a lot of collections that are like Queen's buildings or, you know, nice sort of commemorative things that you can give as gifts, which is really great. So if you have, you know, kids attending Queen's, it's a nice little, Christmas gift. We do things like, tragically hip collections. So if you have like hip fans in your family, I think they give really well as gifts. And then, it's just sort of a nice thing to sort of recognize those places in the city that have, you know, special meaning for you.
Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, this lineup includes a lot of iconic places in Kingston. I was wondering if you could walk us through the 2025 releases and maybe a bit about how some of them were chosen.
So this year's lineup is really wonderful. So we start out next week with the Bages Brewery, which is a beautiful building that has since been turned into condos. But it is on Wellington Street. Following that, we have Louise House. So Louise House is on Johnson Street, and it's sort of an architectural treasure. It began as a new schoolhouse for the Kingston Board of Trustees. Just a really, really beautiful building. Queen students would especially recognize this building because it is now the Starbucks on the corner of Johnson and Division. So that's the building we're talking about there. The Broom Factory is week three. So one of the main, I would say, live music venues in the city used to be a Broom Factory. And now, like I said, it operates as a live music venue. It also houses like the Kingston Canadian Film Festival, Prue, so lots of sort of creative brains in that building. Fourth week is McBurney Park, or more commonly known as Skeleton Park. So Skeleton Park is, you know, definitely one of the most popular sort of gathering spaces for young families in the downtown core. They do a wonderful festival every year, Skeleton Park Arts Fest. And it has like a pretty fun history. It was established in 1800s as Kingston's upper burial ground, which is sort of why it got the sort of Skeleton Park name, but very, very cool. And then finally, week five, it's sort of the ornament itself has a number of different sort of iconic emblems of the Royal Military College of Canada. So it's RC, the RMC ornament, which again, we've done a lot with Queens. We have in the past sort of touched on some of the RMC monuments, but this is sort of an all-encompassing like RMC ornament because their 150th anniversary is coming up. So that's this year's lineup.
Awesome. And I'm sure a lot of these were community suggestions, but I was wondering if any of these were like people have been asking for them like crazy and you guys were like, we have to do it this year.
Definitely. Skeleton Park, we get a lot. That one's a little bit tricky. Buildings are a little bit more simple in terms of rendering into an ornament. Skeleton Park is a very cool one because we sort of used an aerial shot to sort of fashion the ornament. But the Skeleton Park community, sort of that community, they're very, it's a very close-knit community. And so, yeah, we get a lot of suggestions for that one. And then I'm not sure how the other ones came in. I think we always look for buildings that have some kind of historical significance so that we can tell the story of the building. I do think it was someone from Queens who talked about the Starbucks building, though, because, yeah, we know it as the Starbucks, but it's kind of cool that that it started as a schoolhouse.
Mm-hmm. You're also including past ornaments this year, which is a new kind of thing. I was wondering if you could talk a bit about that. Yeah. What made you guys this year decide to offer that?
Yeah. So on our website, which is downtownkingston.ca, we still have ornaments available from past collections. So we definitely, you know, popular ones go pretty quick. And so, you know, they tend to sell out pretty fast, but it's kind of surprising going back 31 years what we still have in our catalog here. And so you can go on the website and take a look through the years. Maybe you're trying to fill in some gaps in your own collection or just kind of see what we've done historically. But those are available to purchase. They're around $8 each. And then we've put together little themed collections this year. So we have one that's a Tragically Hip themed collection. So in there, it would be the Gord Downie Pier, the hip sign at Slush Puppy Place, things like that. We've also done one which is sort of those classic Kingston sort of buildings. When you, you know, you come to Kingston, you have to see City Hall, you have to see Kingston Penn, that sort of thing. So really fun, cute little themed collections that are also available on the website.
You also have that connection where folks bring their downtown shopping receipts. I was wondering if you could just talk about that connection to supporting local business as well.
Yeah. So the whole program started, like you said, we are a BIA, and so it's really important that we support our member businesses and try to drive business and keep downtown as lively and vibrant as we can. And so in order to purchase the new collection, so the old collections are available on our website, as I mentioned. The new collection, you have to present $25 worth of receipts from downtown. So it could be a cafe, could be a retail shop, it could be your dentist, it could be food basics like the grocery store. So any downtown business, you present $25 worth of receipts and the ornament is $10. So, and the ornaments are available in three locations starting on Monday. So they're available at the Grand Theater box office. They're available at the Slush Puppy Place box office and the Visitor Information Center, which is across from City Hall. So you go in with your $25 worth of receipts and the ornaments are available to you at $10.
You've been listening to Jim McDonald with the Downtown Kingston BIA on this year's new pewter ornament collection. For more details on the designs and the release schedule, more information is available at downtownkingston.ca. Fans of CBC's Murdoch Mysteries will have a chance to see the show and its music in a whole new way this month. On November 22nd, the Kingston Symphony presents Murder in F Major at the Kingston Grand Theater. It's a hybrid concert, part live performance, part behind-the-scenes deep dive into one of Canada's longest-running TV dramas. I spoke with the show's composer, Robert Carley, and actor Thomas Craig, who plays Chief Constable Brackenreed, about what Kingston audiences can expect.
Well, it's a it's a good question, actually, Christina, because a lot of people don't know what to expect, because it's not quite like going to go see a movie with the orchestra, which is very popular now, like going to see E.T. or Star Wars. And it's not quite a variety show. It's somewhere in between.
The evening unfolds in two parts, an interactive behind-the-scenes first half and then a full screening of the Murdoch Mysteries episode Murder in F Major, with the score performed live by the Kingston Symphony.
In the first half of the evening, Tom is our host, and he walks us through a lot of behind the scenes, an introduction to the world of Murdoch, for starters. And then we do some behind the scenes work. We do some repertoire from the symphony. We also, you know, shine a light on the Kingston Symphony and what they do. And maybe there's a couple surprises. Maybe Tom might sing a song. Can't tell you everything. But so it's a bit of a 45 minute first half with Tom walking us through these different things, a lot of laughs. And then the second half of the show, we screen the episode in its entirety with the live orchestra, this Kingston Symphony, performing the soundtrack.
We actually go through how Rob puts music to scenes. So we'll show a scene with no music, and then Rob breaks it down for the audience and shows how he puts the strings, the various orchestra pieces to it. It's very clever and it's very informative.
It's a fan favorite when we sort of, you know, see behind the scenes, see how things are made.
The episode Murder in F Major premiered in 2023 during the show's 16th season. And it's a fitting choice as Murdoch investigates the murder of Toronto Symphony director.
Well, it revolves around a murder of an orchestra member. Is it an orchestra member, Rob?
Yeah, it's the general manager of the
orchestra.
I won't be telling too much because it happens in the first scene. The general manager, the guy in charge. So you get to see, it's a backdrop for all of the bits, like the different players, the personnel manager, you know, the soloist, you know, they're implicated, all the different, the conductor, you know, all the different characters that make up a symphony orchestra, become our cast of characters.
There's a nice running gag through it where the character Crabtree keeps asking the orchestra leader what he actually does.
Yeah, what does a conductor do?
What does a conductor do?
People often say that too. What exactly do you do up there waving your hands? It's great. It's clever.
Carley and Craig say these live events are also a rare chance to work directly together and get a glimpse into each other's worlds, something they don't get to witness while making the show.
Well, you know, it's funny. I mean, I work in post-production, like in the different parts of a TV show, I don't get to really see the action on set or mm-hmm. work with the actors very rarely. So this to me is a bit of a treat because I get to work with, Tom or Yannick or whoever the host might be. And then they talk a bit about their experience on set. And it's just a nice, you know, intersection of those two worlds. I work in my studio in a vacuum by myself. I rarely get out of the house, so to speak. And these guys, they don't see the final. I see the final product like almost immediately. That's where I start. I start at the end, and they are months behind me. So what Tom does, he'll go to work and he'll. Well, you tell me, Tom. You do a scene. It's kind of just fragments, and then you don't even.
Yeah, know. I don't see the final cut on that till it's on TV. Really.
This won't be Carley or Craig's first visit to Kingston, and the city is certainly familiar to Murdoch viewers as well, with its historic architecture making regular appearances in the series.
Well, I'll tell you what the first couple of episodes we did, we used to do read-throughs, and there was a character who escaped from Kingston, and I didn't know, I'd only been in Canada a couple of weeks, I didn't know there was a Kingston. And I'm thinking, Kingston, Jamaica, why are we dealing? I just thought it was Jamaica we were talking about. I didn't realise there was a Kingston 2 hours down the road from Toronto. So yeah, I never knew about Kingston, Ontario until I was here, really. But it's a lovely town, been there quite a few times. It's a really sweet place to be, good restaurants, nice harbour.
I think a couple of our scripts have revolved around the prison,
yeah.
Like Tom mentioned, but they've actually, I think, did you guys shoot in the prison? I think you went into one of the...
There was a prison episode they went into, but I wasn't involved in that. But I've filmed in Kingston a few times. We met up on the streets.
It's pretty town. You know, a lot of Ontario towns, they didn't do a great job of preserving their downtown. You know, all those limestone buildings. I think only Kingston and maybe Guelph have done it well. A lot of them just tore it down and put up parking garages that, you know, serve a use, I guess, but they just don't have the aesthetic charm that Kingston has.
Murdoch in Concert has been staged across Canada, and Carly and Craig are excited to hear the Kingston Symphony's take on it. It's also a great opportunity for Murdoch fans to get to know their local orchestra.
Well, we've done a few of these, so I've worked with the Saskatoon Symphony Orchestra, the Edmonton Symphony Orchestra, and the Halifax, Nova Scotia. So I'm looking forward to the Kingston Symphony Orchestra, see how they measure up.
Yeah, we're on a bit of a tour. Like, we do this show in different cities. We try to bring it to, you know, Murdoch Mysteries, as you know, Christine, is been around 19 seasons. It's got a big fan base from coast to coast. So we find that we can go into different communities and try to bring out the fans and often tell them about their local orchestra, because it's true that a lot of our audiences, I don't know what the measure is, maybe it's a third, have never been to the orchestra before. So it's an opportunity for, and this was one of the intentions of creating Murdoch in Concert by the executive producer, Christina Jennings. She really wanted to shine a light on the orchestras locally in the community, using Murdoch, trying to get those fans, because there's a bit of a Venn diagram where people who go to the symphony often, or watch the show, I mean, they all kind of, you know, they're all nerds, you might say.
Also notably, for the first time ever, the production will not be bringing their touring conductor. Instead, Kingston Symphony's own Evan Mitchell will lead the performance, making this a uniquely local edition of a show that's toured across the country.
And so we're going to try something different. We have a new conductor first time. So it's the homegrown conductor of the Kingston Symphony Orchestra. So it's pretty special.
Yeah, because we usually have a conductor who travels with us, who steps in at all the different orchestras, don't we?
Yeah, Lucas Walden has done it many, many times with us. But Evan is really well known in the film world as being a really...
Oh, great.
Yeah, he's really going to be a lot of fun.
And if past shows are any indication, Carly and Craig say fans walk away with a whole new appreciation for the music behind Murdoch Mysteries.
Well, it's a thrill for me. I mean, I'm so lucky to have a Canadian TV show have this kind of platform where it can go out and it can be, you know, perform with these great orchestras is just a real thrill for me. It's just, I'm so excited. And I think the audience hears it too. I mean, I think everyone loves, you know, that experience of watching something that, and they kind of didn't even notice that there's music. I mean, they do, I guess, in a certain way, but you don't really, when you're watching a film or a television show, you shouldn't be listening to the music really that much. It's more of an emotional character or giving you emotional beats. But then when you have an opportunity to see it being performed, it kind of changes things a little bit. It's a nice, wonderful experience, I think, for people.
No, I do a meet and greet afterwards, so you get the feedback from the audience on the night. Do you know what I mean? And people are surprised how much they loved it, and they've never been to see a symphony orchestra before. Because, like Rob says, we've got that Murdoch fan base who don't necessarily go on to a symphony. So it's fantastic, that crossover.
Once again, Murder in F Major takes place November 22nd at 7:30 p.m. at the Kingston Grand Theatre. Tickets for the show and a meet and greet with Thomas Craig are both available at kingstonsymphony.ca. For CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative, this has been Christina Laurie. Before we get into more local news, I'm going to turn to our weather and traffic report for today featuring CFRC's Jesse Bell.
This is Jesse Bell with your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Friday, November 21st, warmest day of the week, high of 9 degrees, but there is a 90% chance of precipitation, which will cool things back down as Saturday, November 22nd, we'll get a daytime high of 4 with partly sunny conditions dropping down to just a shade below freezing overnight. Sunday, November 23rd, daytime high of 5, low of 0, and then the start of next week, Monday, November 24th, a 5-degree day with a mix of sun and cloud. This is your City of Kingston traffic report for the week. As a reminder, we have the nighttime Santa Claus Parade and Tree Lighting Ceremony this Saturday, November 22nd, and there are some relevant road closures related to that. Market Street, Ontario to King, will be closed from 8 a.m. to 11 p.m. King Street, Brock to Clarence, will be closed from 5:30 p.m. to 9 p.m. And Princess Street, Sir John A. Macdonald to Ontario, will be closed from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. Here are some non-holiday-related road closures. Aberdeen Street, William to Johnson, is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging. Albert, Princess to Mac, is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging. Berry Street, Queen to Colborne, is closed for construction-related activity at 283 Queen Street. Earl, Collingwood to Toronto, is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. King Street, Tragically Hip Way to Place d'Armes, is closed November 19th from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. for the Kingston Frontenacs school day game. King Street, Tragically Hip Way to Place d'Armes, is closed November 19th at 8 p.m. to November 21st at 8 a.m. for Blue Rodeo related event parking and storage at Slush Puppy Place. Kings Court Avenue, Concession to First, is closed until November 21st for gas main installation. Sydenham Road, Princess to Cataraqui Woods, is closed November 17th and 18th from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. each day to facilitate the safe operation of a crane lift. Raglan Road, Division to Main, is closed until November 30th from 7:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. each day for gas main installation. Toronto Street, Durham to Park, is closed November 3rd to November 28th for installation of new water main, sanitary, and storm services. And Victoria Street, Union to Johnson, is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work.
Thank you, Jesse. Now back to more local news. For the first time ever, researchers are studying whether non-hallucinogenic doses of psilocybin, the active compound found in psychedelic mushrooms, could help to treat generalized anxiety disorder. The Kingston Health Sciences Center Research Institute is leading this first-of-its-kind Health Canada-approved Phase 2A clinical trial. The trial will be testing the daily, at-home use of microdose psilocybin to see if it can safely ease anxiety symptoms without the trip. Generalized anxiety disorder affects about 5% of Canadian adults, more than 1.6 million people. And while it's common, many existing treatments can be slow to work or cause side effects that make long-term use difficult. Principal investigator of the study, Dr. Claudio Suarez, sat down with CFRC to tell us more about this first-of-its-kind clinical trial and what it could mean for the future of anxiety treatment. To start us off, I was wondering if you'd like to just introduce yourself for our listeners.
Well, my name is Claudio Suarez. I'm a psychiatrist here at Queen's University. I'm professor of psychiatry at Queen's. I'm also a clinician who sees patients in the medical and surgical floors from psychiatry. I work also in oncology and palliative care. And I do research. I'm the director of the Center for Psychedelics Health and Research at Providence Care, and also doing research on psychedelics here at KGH.
Great, thank you. And getting into our topic today, I was wondering if you could start us off by speaking to the gaps and challenges in current treatments that have kind of led to us turning to exploring these alternative methods.
For sure. So as you know, we have a lot of people suffering from depression and anxiety, like more kind of a clinical disabling anxiety, like 1 out of 6 Canadians have anxiety. And not everybody do well, not everyone does well on medications, right? So we have psychotherapies that are quite effective for anxiety. But again, not everybody has access to psychotherapy and not everybody responded to psychotherapy. And the medications that we have are primarily antidepressants that we use for anxiety. Some patients responded well, but they can't tolerate side effects. They have, you know, weight gain or sexual dysfunction. So we're always looking for new treatments for anxiety to have another tool in our toolbox. And psychedelics are emerging as kind of promising treatments for anxiety. So that's why one of the things we're looking for is the use of a low dose or microdosing psychedelics, in this case, psilocybin for anxiety.
Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you could speak a bit to the background and evidence so far, just where we're at with psilocybin specifically.
Sure. So psilocybin is the active ingredient of the magic mushrooms, right? So they have been used in like recreationally, but also in ritual and religious ceremonies for many, many, many years. And probably over the last 10 or 15 years, we're kind of experiencing like a renaissance in research on psychedelics. People are rediscovering psychedelics as potential medical treatments and trying to apply what we know about psychedelics for many years into the medical setting. So we see a lot of studies happening in psychedelics, particularly psilocybin, for depression, anxiety, to reduce cravings for alcohol in patients who have alcohol use disorder, and for PTSD as well. Although PTSD is more MDMA, that has been studied for that. But the psychedelics, Christina, in most studies, the predominant school of thoughts for psychedelics is to use what we call macrodoses, right? So people have a dose that induces changes in their perception of the environment, and perception of themselves. That's what we call the altered states of consciousness, or the trip. It's like people go through a hallucinogenic trip, which is it's an epiphenomenal. So there's a lot of things happening in your brain at the time that you do that. But that requires patients to come to a medical setting and use that medication and be under observation for at least 6 to 8 hours. So it's labor intensive. There are some more risks and side effects involved. The more recent school of thoughts were in parallel to that, we're looking at using psilocybins in lower doses that will not cause that whole experience of psychedelics from the hallucinogenic point of view, but will still have beneficial effects in your brain, maybe increasing neuroplasticity, maybe help you to reduce the ruminative thoughts or the, you know, constant worrying that you have and anxiety. And they seem to work well. So there are some promising studies, but they have not been tested in a more kind of a, I would say, structured way. So that's the first study that we are aware of that's using microdosing delivered at home to be used at home for anxiety.
Mm-hmm. And again, you're talking about microdosing there and kind of getting into the nitty gritty. I was wondering if you could dive a bit deeper into what this means, either in practical or neurological terms, as opposed to, you know, going on a full macro dose and having those experiences.
For sure. So when we talk about macro dose or higher doses of psilocybin, usually we're talking about taking at least 25 or 30 milligrams of psilocybin, which then will induce that altered states of consciousness or, you know, what recreationally people call a trip, right? And that is probably the way or the mechanism by which psilocybin works in macrodoses. So it's a boost of effects at once that cause a cascade of reactions in your brain, increase neuroplasticity, and then opens that what we call more flexibility in your cognition to deal with anxiety. And that is done in combination with psychotherapy. So the notion is that you're using the macro dose to make it easier for patients to engage in psychotherapy and make it easier for them to be more cognitively flexible, to be more psychologically open to psychotherapy. When we're using microdosing, you're usually using a much lower dose, so it's between 1 to 3 milligrams. The sweet spot that we're trying to study is around 3 milligrams because it's just below the threshold for changing your brain from the hallucinogenic point of view. So at that dose, you're using the pharmacological effects of the psilocybin. So you're not inducing the hallucinogenic trips. You're not inducing changes in your perception. It's almost like using the same pathway that we use in antidepressants, but without having the side effects of the antidepressants. So the idea here is to use psilocybin more as a medicine as opposed to a catalyst for psychotherapy.
Mm-hmm. Interesting, because I think a lot of people, I think about psychedelic treatment as the experience of the trip is more so what's solving your issues or helping you work through it. But this sounds like it's more like those chemical changes in your brain, and that it's a bit different. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. So, and that's, you know, what you mentioned before, the psychedelic experience make it easier for you to do psychotherapy. This is probably the predominant classic way of thinking about psychedelics. And probably, I want to say 80 to 90% of the research on psychedelics so far has been focused on that way of delivering psychedelics. But we also know that psychedelics are neuroplastogens. So they change the brain plasticity, and they also have effects through serotonin in your brain, the same chemical that we use in antidepressants. So it's interacting with the same receptors that we use in medications, for instance, for depression and anxiety. So what we're looking at here is to benefit from, you know, slow doses or low dose of psilocybin delivered every day for a period of time, similar to what we do with other medications, but hopefully have a more enduring and less troubled from the side effect point of view that we have with antidepressants. So minimizing sexual dysfunction or weight gain or all the other side effects that sometimes are a major barrier for people to take medication for anxiety.
Mm-hmm. And getting into this clinical trial, what's that going to kind of look like, and what makes it such a first in Canada?
So this is the first time that we're aware of that Health Canada has approved a study to allow us to give patients microdosing psilocybin to bring it home and take it home. So as you know, psilocybin is illegal, so you cannot or you should not go and buy psilocybin anywhere. So in order for you to do studies on psilocybin, we have to apply to a lot of the regulatory bodies, including Health Canada, to get permission to obtain the psilocybin and store the psilocybin. So that has been done for other studies as well. But this study in particular allow us to then have a protocol in which patients come and try psilocybin for the first time in our hospital. They stay here for a few hours. We make sure that they don't have any unusual responses to psilocybin. And then they can take the medication at home. So they go home with a 1 week's worth of medication, and then they can use the medication at home. We monitor that very closely. And then they come every week to be reassessed up to 4 weeks. So it's a 4-week trial. And then people who responded well can stay for another 4 weeks when we then randomize them to be either on placebo or to remain on psilocybin. So that we're going to be looking at if they have any withdrawal symptoms or rebound anxiety after using for 4 weeks. So the total study is 8 weeks, but the first 4 weeks, everybody knows you're taking medication. And then the next 4 weeks, we split them between placebo and medication.
Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, what kind of outcomes are you measuring?
Yeah, so this is a phase two trial. So the clinical trials have different phases. So phase one usually is what we're looking at if the new medication is toxic or trying to find the right spot, so to speak, on the dosing. So that's how we end up with a 3-milligram dosing for this study. So this is a phase two trial. Phase two trials are usually small trials, like less than 100 patients. When we're trying to look at primarily safety and tolerability. So we're looking at if patients have any side effects. We check their blood work to see if their, you know, kidneys are working well, their liver, their heart, to make sure that everything is okay prior to, but also make sure the medication doesn't impact their health in general. But we also collect some data on efficacy. So we look at scales for anxiety, measure their anxiety, their self-perception of anxiety, how well they are functioning at home or work or at school. So there are a few measures that we use to look at success. And that study will inform, hopefully, a phase three trials. For phase three are larger trials, more like what we see when we're applying for new medications to Health Canada or FDA. We have to use a phase three trial. So these are larger trials. But this trial that we're doing will inform the next one if everything goes well.
Mm-hmm. And I was just going to ask you, just as a clinician and as a scientist, what excites you about diving into this research?
Well, so when I got involved with psychedelic research probably close to 3 or 4 years ago, when Queen's decided to put together an advisory board to look at psychedelic medicine. And I came from the field on psychiatry, mood disorders, but also see patients in oncology. So I was aware of the major gaps that we have in the treatments that we have for depression, anxiety, but also PTSD and oncology. A lot of patients with late stage cancer have what we call existential distress, and that really doesn't respond well to medication. And psychedelics have emerged in the last few years as a promising option for many of those patients. But there are not a lot of clinical trials happening in Canada. And I became fascinated with some of the options. And I saw and I've seen I did a long training in US, close to 1 year on psychedelic research. And I'd seen both patients and participants, but also videos with dramatic changes very quickly. So I became quite fascinated by the promising effects, but also very aware that psychedelic research comes with a lot of stigma, a lot of mistrust and misinformation. So getting involved in research, but also helping to destigmatize psychedelics and find the right population that can use, it became one of the areas that I'm quite interested in. So we created a Center for Psychedelics at Providence Care. We opened last year, and we're doing research both at Providence Care, but also at KGH as well.
Mm-hmm. And what are you hoping this means for the future of care in this area?
So I think if we can learn when and how psychedelics can be helpful, that will inform probably in a better way how can we use psychedelics in the medical setting versus recreational, which is one of the challenges with cannabis, for instance. Right? When cannabis became legalized, the research on cannabis suffered because a lot of the medical cannabis research became very difficult to conduct studies because people just go across the street and buy what they think they're buying, right, in terms of concentration and use. So what we're trying to do is to avoid that we make some of the mistakes that we made with cannabis in general, that we understand how psychedelics can be used safely for medical purpose. So then if or when psychedelics become legalized, we can clearly differentiate what is psychedelic use for medical practice versus psychedelics for recreation.
Mm-hmm. And just to wrap us up here, who can take part in this study and how can people get involved or learn more?
Yeah, so people can reach out to us. So they can look at, you know, CS research at queensu.ca, but they can also reach out to KGSC or the Center for Psychedelics at Providence Care. What we're looking for this particular study are anyone ages 18 to 60. Whose primary diagnosis is anxiety. Either they were diagnosed with anxiety by their GP or their primary care or psychiatrist, or they were medicated for anxiety in the past, and they're having right now anxiety that's really affecting their ability to function, like constant worries or concerns, inability to function due to anxiety. They cannot be suffering from major depression or psychosis or alcohol use disorder. But we will screen them. We will have an assessment. And if they qualify, they can come to the study. We do a series of medical assessments to make sure they are healthy otherwise. And then they can join the study.
Once again, that was Dr. Claudio Suarez, who will be leading a first-of-its-kind study on the use of psychedelics to treat generalized anxiety disorder at the Kingston Health Sciences Center Research Institute. As one of the largest mental health research trials currently underway at KHSC, the study represents an important step in advancing evidence-based innovation in psychiatric care. As Dr. Suarez mentioned, researchers are currently seeking adults living with generalized anxiety disorder to join the study. To learn more or inquire about participation, you can contact the research team by email at cs.research@queensu.ca. Queen's University has officially joined the Canadian Blood Service's first-ever Fall Get-Together campaign, a nationwide challenge uniting 106 colleges and universities to help Canada reach a major milestone, 1 million active blood and plasma donors in the next 5 years. Canadian Blood Services is a vital lifeline for many Canadians, supporting blood, plasma, stem cell, organ, and tissue donations across the country. Between now and December 31st, students are encouraged to give together by booking group donation appointments at local donor centers. Each campus competes for the highest donor point average, with top schools earning limited edition hoodies and a Friendsgiving banquet. Debbie Barfoot with Canadian Blood Services sat down with CFRC to share more about this new initiative and the Queen's Campus Challenge.
This fall, we're launching the Fall Get Together, which is a national donor challenge that celebrates the power of giving together. We're speaking directly to groups, friends, families, colleagues, classmates, teammates, programs, and inviting them to book and donate together. The Campus Challenge works that at all post-secondary school environments across Canada, we're encouraging campuses to set up a team if they're not already registered in the Partners for Life program. and then to add members to that team and make a group donation together. So points are accumulated through your membership numbers and the group donations that the campus does together. Across the board, all across Canada, we're seeing many schools get involved and many new schools get involved. So that's important. That's the whole purpose of the campaign, is to engage people to get involved with the campus and donate blood so they can assist and support patients all across Canada who need blood and blood products to maintain and live a healthy lifestyle.
While this challenge is a first for post-secondary schools across Canada, Barfoot says Queen's is no stranger to supporting the cause, with a long-standing history of student donors and blood drives on campus.
So Queen's University has been involved in our Partners for Life program since inception. Queen's set up a national partnership team over 25 years ago. And it was developed and started by some nursing students at Queen's. Throughout the years, we have a very active club on campus called Queen's University Blood Team, which is QUBT for short. They raised awareness about the need for people to join the stem cell registry and to donate blood. They organize group donations. We have on-campus blood drives that they support and volunteer at. For this campaign, the campaign results only display nationally the top 10. And at this point, Queen's is not on the top 10. So I'm putting the challenge out there.
As Barfoot mentioned, there's still work to be done, both at Queen's and across the country, to reach CBS's goal of 1 million new donors in the next 5 years.
Obviously, as the population increases, so does the need for blood and blood products. With that comes a need for blood donors to support to ensure that the demand is met. The demand is met through hospital patients, people that require surgeries. We need to increase our national donor base to 1 million over the next 5 years. People might fall out of the blood system for numerous reasons. So we always need to replenish. And this is especially important for the younger. So minimum age is 17 to donate blood. So we encourage our youth to get out and learn more about donating blood, check their eligibility, and then join this challenge and the national campaign, as well as the Queen's University Blood Team.
And she adds, joining as a team is one of the best ways to make an impact.
More than a third of Canadians under the age of 35 who have donated blood before have done so as part of a group. So it's a great way for a group to get together and give together. Also, it can be less intimidating if you're a first-time blood donor to go with a group of friends, fellow students, or colleagues, so you can donate together and go through the experience first time as a team. It's a cool way to get together and understand that you are really giving back to fellow Canadians.
Queen students can take part in the Fall Get Together campaign by booking group donations.
I would encourage every student to first go online to blood.ca, take the eligibility quiz, make sure that you are eligible to donate. We have a fantastic website that goes through the parameters, the criteria, and explains the need for blood and blood products. Once they determine if they are eligible, to reach out to the Queen's University Blood Team, join one of their upcoming group donations because they have many in the book.
Once again, that was Debbie Barfoot with Canadian Blood Services on this year's first ever Fall Get Together campaign. To learn more and book a group donation, you can head to blood.ca. Before we wrap up this morning, we're going to run through your Friday forecast, a roundup of just some of the events Kingston has to offer this weekend. Starting off with tonight, Friday, November 21st, if you're looking to kick off the weekend with something fun, Bitch and Drag Bingo is on at Carlo Estates Winery at 6. You can also test your knowledge with trivia at Wild Wings Kingston at 7. Over at the Grand, I Take Your Hand in Mine continues its run at 7:30 p.m. And Guys and Dolls hits the stage at La Sesame Theatre, also at 7:30. For live music tonight, Happy Hour starts early at the RCHA at 4 o'clock, followed by Chris Morris at the Toucan and Chris Murphy of Turpin's Trail at the Cove Inn, both at 5. At 6, you'll find Scott Owen at Creekside and Wildcard at Time Out. Some big shows tonight also include Pearl, a Janis Joplin experience at the Spire, and Virginia to Vegas with Noel at the Broom Factory, both at 7:30. On Saturday, November 22nd, it's a packed day downtown with the Kingston Public Market from 9 to 5, leading into the Santa Claus Parade down Princess Street at 5, ending with the tree lighting in Springer Market Square at 7. Theater continues with I Take Your Hand in Mine and Guys and Dolls, both offering 2 p.m. and 7:30 p.m. performances. For live music, Logan Brown will be at Time Out at 3 p.m., Jumpcast will be at The Spire at 7:30 p.m., Painted Moons will be at the RCHA at 8 p.m., and Ambush will be at The Buckle at 9 p.m. On Sunday, November 23rd, the Memorial Center Farmers Market opens from 9 to 1. And then we have a full lineup of concerts. Will Turnbull and Logan Brown will be at Spearhead at 2 p.m. Mozart's Requiem with the Kingston Choral Society will be at the Spire at 2:30 p.m. And Lemon Bucket Orchestra will be at the Broom Factory at 3. A big headliner on Sunday night, also the Strumbrellas will be performing at the Kingston Grand at 7:30 p.m. Easing into next week, on Monday, November 24th, trivia lovers can hit the Brass Pub at 7:45 or Something in the Water Brewing at 8 p.m. You can also ease into the week with some live music with Jonathan Jones at the Cove Inn at 5 p.m. and heavy music at the Mansion starting at 7 p.m. or live jazz at Musiki at 8. Once again, that was your Friday forecast, just some of the events happening around Kingston this week. You can check out CFRC.ca for our full listing of concerts and events. That is all things current in Kingston for this week. Thank you for listening to CFRC's local news programming, brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. To listen on the go and hear more from some of our guests, head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
What'll I Wear offers the best in vintage, funky, one-of-a-kind treasures, clothing, accessories, and a fabulous selection of jewels, vintage and new. Find the cutest purse, the most dashing of hats and sunglasses, everything to complete your individual look. What'll I Wear has it all. They can dress you from top to bottom. Find your new fashion fave at What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street in Kingston. Visit their new location and follow them on Facebook to keep up to date with what's in store at What'll I Wear. Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present a selection from local jazz musician Oscar Evans' latest work, Live at Hotel Wolf Island. The album is a live recording from a quartet performance featuring Jonathan Stewart on saxophone, Nick Kornelik on piano, Andy Love on drums, and Oscar Evans on upright bass. Recorded in front of a live audience in March 2025, the album is a stellar example of Oscar's musicianship as a band leader and upright bassist. Follow Oscar on Instagram at Oscar Mayfield Evans for upcoming releases and exciting performance announcements. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visit kingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream Live at Wolf Island by Oscar Evans on your favorite platforms and enjoy a selection from it called I Mean You with us now here on CFRC 101.9 FM. We'll be right back. Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office and supported by your friends at Modern City Taxi, we're pleased to present a single from Westport-based artist Resonant Transitions, a.k.a. Ken Little's debut album, Hearken Organum. The new album was recorded at the Spire and captures Ken's unique composition and playing style, bringing new sounds with cymbals, gongs, and percussion instruments. Stay tuned for tickets to Ken's album release concert taking place at the Spire on November 16th. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visit kingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream Hearken Organum now on your favorite platforms and enjoy a selection from it called Rejoinder here with us on CFRC 101.9 FM.